This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Jeremy Scahill has written an excellent article, Little-Known Military Thug Squad Still Brutalizing Prisoners in Gitmo Under Obama.
If you thought conditions at Guantanamo were going to change, that irfing or beating people into a pulp would stop, Jeremy tells us you're wrong.
We'll also speak with Chris Hedges, journalist and author, who's just written a very important article called Bind Brand Obama.
It's not chance that the Obama campaign won the Advertising Age Best Campaign of the Year. What do we have here? All hype and no substance, or no substance we can believe in? Stay with us.
Michael, it looks like the military commissions, which Obama indicated he'd no longer continue with on the Bush score, are going to be continued.
Well, you know, he heavily criticized the military commissions, but we knew there might be a problem. Military commissions, as our listeners recall, are the rump kangaroo court system that for 7 years the Bush administration has been trying to somehow figure out how to try people with at Guantanamo. And, of course, it's been a colossal failure. They're the ones that allow torture evidence, hearsay, and everything else, and basically their system of conviction. Obama had been very critical of them, said people could be tried in either courts-martials or regular federal courts. But there was a warning here. When he took office, he only suspended military commissions for 4 months. And now, lo and behold, this last week, he announced that he would continue military commissions, but he would add some bells and whistles, or maybe you could say some Christmas ornaments, decorate them a little better so that they look a little better. But in fact, at bottom, they're terrible. They're awful. A deviation from 225 years of courts in the United States. They send a message in the world that military commissions are okay. And what's interesting to me at the Center for Constitutional Rights is currently we're suing an oil company that we claim was implicated in the death of someone, Ken Sarawiwa, in Nigeria, who was convicted by, what else, a military commission. So here we have the United States buying into, adopting, embracing really something that should have been treated as utterly outside the pale, completely off. And Obama administration has embraced it. It's sad, but unfortunately, with regard to these core human rights, civil liberties issues surrounding Guantanamo, surrounding Bagram, surrounding the so-called war on terror, the Obama administration so far has not indicated that it's change we can believe in.
Well, Michael, what about the refusal of the Obama administration to give those 2,000 photographs of torture victims up to the press?
Well, it's a related and second update. You know, we've had a lawsuit with the ACLU. They've been taking the primary responsibility. The center's been involved with it. That has gotten thousands of documents out of the government with regard to torture. A few years ago, there were appeals and various lawsuits around the 2,000 or so photographs that were scheduled to be released on May 28th. And there was pretty open that it was going to happen, that the Obama administration was going to not oppose the request, the court was going to order it, et cetera. Well, again, last week, the Obama administration took back its words and said it wasn't going to order them. It was going to actually oppose their release and go into court and oppose it. It's an amazing blow, and it's amazing cave-in to torture, to the military, and conceivably to the new general that he had appointed in Afghanistan. General McChrystal apparently was involved in some of what will be seen in these photographs or teams under him, the brutality and the torture in these photographs. Now, when Obama said he didn't want to release them, he gave a number of reasons. One of them, a couple of them, are just awful. One of them says, well, there's nothing new here. It's not going to further the situation. You've seen it before. Well, if we've seen it before, why can't we see it again? Pretty lame excuse. A second excuse is, of course, is that the Muslim world will be angry if we released photographs. Well, I can't imagine that they have anything to be angry about. We've just bombed the heck out of them in Iraq, or bombing the heck out of them in Afghanistan, and Pakistan have created almost 2 million refugees in Pakistan in the last few months, and have carried out torture at Guantanamo and are still running Bagram. So I'm not sure the problem here is releasing a few photographs. The problem here underlies U.S. foreign policy, and all the speeches Obama wants to give to the Muslim world aren't going to make any difference when that's what the issues are. So we've had real flip-flops on military commissions as well as on the photographs. And, of course, just this last week, we've had the Senate Democrats joining the axis of denials of civil and human rights, joining or at least publicly joining. They've been in there for a while, when they have now in both houses of Congress essentially said they're not going to take any Guantanamo detainees in the United States. They're not authorizing a penny to move anybody here. And that includes people like the Uyghurs who've been at Guantanamo for 7 years. They're completely innocent. There's people in this country, Uyghur families, who are willing to take them. And yet you're seeing the Senate's lockstep with the Republicans on saying, we don't want to take them.
Which means they're not going to close down Guantanamo anytime too soon.
Well, Michael, maybe they'll take them to Bagram, a place we don't have access to. I hope not. Today, once again, we're happy to have with us writer, activist, Jeremy Scahill, well known for his book, Blackwater, and now for a new article called Little Known Military Thug Squad Still Brutalizing Prisoners at Guantanamo Under Obama. Jeremy is really the first one to bring to wide public attention squads of five men used at Guantanamo as what are called IRF squads, or immediate reaction forces. In fact, when a Guantanamo detainee talks to their lawyer, sometimes they'll say they've been IRFed. And what it means is they've been beaten to a bloody pulp, hogtied, and brutalized for basically doing nothing but existing. Jeremy points out in his article, this was not just a Bush policy. It's a policy and a practice that has sadly continued under our current president, President Obama.
Jeremy Scahill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be back.
It's great to have you, Jeremy. Your writing is still sharp, pointed, exceptional. And your predictions about where Obama would be at this point were, sadly to say, dead on accurate.
I think that we have this sort of exercise in intellectual dishonesty every election cycle, particularly when we're coming off of 8 years of Republican rule, where everyone wants to believe that the rhetoric of the Democrat who's running for office is actually going to be implemented, you know, where you have Obama talking about change. The reality, though, is that we have a one-party system, particularly when it comes to foreign policy, and Obama is showing that very clearly.
I think that, that's absolutely
right. In one particular place that we're interested in on Law and Disorder, and that's Guantanamo. And in a recent article that we've read, Jeremy, you write about how torture is still going on. How's that working?
Right. I think one of the clearest pieces of evidence that we have that a criminal prosecution of those that authorized the torture, ordered the torture, and carried out the torture would be the best preventative measure from this happening again is the fact that torture is continuing right now at Guantanamo under Barack Obama. Of course, Michael Ratner here has been at the forefront of litigating the illegality of Guantanamo and defending prisoners there. I write about Michael in this article, but the point here is that Obama on January 22nd issued an executive order saying that Guantanamo would be closed in a year. Furthermore, he said that the United States will respect the Geneva Conventions, particularly Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, that would prohibit the abuse of prisoners in U.S. custody. What we know now is that not only is there systematic torture continuing to happen at Guantanamo, but that Obama, and this is what my article is about, is continuing to allow the use of a notorious military police unit at Guantanamo known as the Immediate Reaction Force, the IRF. This force is so notorious that lawyers representing Guantanamo detainees have created a new lexicon or a language to describe the operations of this force. They say that they're IRFing prisoners, or prisoners are being IRFed up by them. In short, this is a riot-type squad that comes in with what Clive Stafford Smith, a great lawyer, describes as Darth Vader outfits. They come into a cell, five men deep. They douse prisoners in chemicals. Each of the five thugs sent in there is assigned to a different body part of the prisoner, the head, the right arm, the left arm, the right leg, the left leg. And their job is to, quote unquote, subdue restive or combative prisoners. What I found in my investigation is that this thug squad, Michael, you've called them the Black Shirts of Guantanamo.
I called them the Black Shirts of Guantanamo, Jeremy, taking from your original book when you asked, when I always made a distinction between U.S., quote, fascism and German, because I said, oh, we don't have people on the street beating people up. And you said, oh, no, Michael, we got Blackwater, right. Black Shirts. And these IRF guys, immediate reaction force people, those are the Black Shirts of Guantanamo.
Because they're being used
There's
to
no
punish
issue.
Prisoners. This is not That's about right. stopping a prisoner from stabbing a guard. This is not about stopping a riot in a prison. Right. What we found is that prisoners who take an extra styrofoam cup after a meal and keep it in their cell as some psychological form of comfort, that they have some other possession in their cell, the IRF teams are called in and they beat them to a pulp. Among the tactics they use, they put prisoners' heads in toilets and then flush the toilet repeatedly. They did that to a British resident named Omar Degg Hayes, who's one of the key figures in the Spanish investigation. They have smeared feces of another prisoner on the face of other prisoners. A man who's being represented by the Center for Constitutional Rights, this was after Obama's inauguration, was doused in chemicals, beaten, and then had one of these IRF team members urinate on his head as part of the quote-unquote disciplinary measures taken. This force, from the lawyers that I've talked to, is entirely illegal in terms of the actions it's taking under international law and under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Scott Horton says that this force was authorized at the highest levels of the Bush administration and says that those who have been brutalized by them should be entitled to compensation. This is still continuing under Obama, and that is the point that I think is most important. When you don't prosecute the torturers, when you don't prosecute those that set the tone for this kind of torture, you encourage it, not allow it, you encourage it to continue, and that's exactly what's happening right
now. What's remarkable to me is we've been unable to stop any of this in this administration. I mean, we have our Guantanamo lawyers, we've had people there, they're doing reports all the time, they're talking to you, your stuff is getting out there to a certain extent, more broadly than any other story before. And yet it continues. That continues. There's people working on the forced feeding, you know, through the right. wide tubes, a form of torture as well. That continues. And then Obama has the nerve to send down some general who was deeply involved before in Guantanamo to say, oh, does this comply with Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention? And of course, the guy comes back with a report saying everything is hunky-dory down at Guantanamo. It complies with Common right. Article 3.
And then you look about the debate, the quote-unquote debate that's happening about the closure of Guantanamo, the Democrats refusing to fund the closure of Guantanamo. Now, this is a very complicated story with a lot of layers, but I will say this. Watching the Senate debate, Harry Reid does not belong in the leadership of the Democratic Party, except if the Democratic Party is exactly what it is, a shill for powerful corporations and a force that's used to continue these kinds of brutal forces. Harry Reid should not be the leader of an opposition party or the leader of a party that proclaims to be about justice. He should be the leader of the kind of corporate party that he is. So I think
his
Harry
statement
Reid is
was
exactly
disgusting.
Where, right.
Disgusting what he said about Guantanamo. I reminded our listeners what he said.
Harry Reid and other powerful Democrats have implied that the Guantanamo prisoners should not be brought to the United States of America and given any access to due process because they would be a threat to U.S. national security. I mean, that is absolutely outrageous.
He's supporting basically legislation that essentially says that people like the Uyghurs, who've been in Guantanamo right. for 7 years, never should have been there to begin with, can't be brought into the United States and can't be put in Washington right. where the Uyghur community in that area has been willing to take them. And he
and
is saying
he started speaking out. This right. really started. Unfortunately, it was Newt Gingrich that really drove this issue in portraying them as somehow a threat to national security if they were brought into the United States.
The Uyghurs
States.
In particular.
Right, the Uyghurs in particular. I mean, you look at some of the notorious, dangerous criminals that the United States has in prison. None of these people are escaping. The real danger here is to the U.S. Constitution if you don't give them access to due process, if you don't allow them to have habeas corpus rights. But Michael, to answer your question about why this isn't going anywhere, I think the reality is that it was a bipartisan program, this torture program. Nancy Pelosi can fumble through papers that someone else wrote all she wants to try to figure out what her line is on torture. But we have known for years, this is an old story, that Nancy Pelosi was at those briefings where these tactics were explicitly discussed. She said it to Rachel Maddow months ago. The Washington Post revealed this in 2007. Nancy Pelosi never made a peep. She never tried to, quote unquote, correct the record. Now that it became an issue, and it's become a partisan issue, unfortunately, when in reality it's a law enforcement issue. This is illegal, what these people have done. Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats on the Intelligence Committee knew damn well what was happening at Guantanamo. Some of them, we understand, may have even encouraged it to become tougher. So when you have that deep of complicity, when the leader of the Democrats, the third most powerful official in the United States of America, Nancy Pelosi, was a part of the authorization program for this illegal torture of prisoners in U.S. custody, you think they're going to want to open up an actual independent investigation with prosecutorial power? No way. This is political, Michael. The reason the Democrats don't want the prosecution is because they themselves would be guilty. The last thing I'll say is this. Michael Scheuer, one of the architects of the Extraordinary Rendition Program, remember it was started under Bill Clinton, the kidnap and torture program, he said on Al Jazeera English to Avi Lewis a couple weeks ago, well, if you're going to start opening the record, then Bill Clinton and I belong on trial. Now, saying that because he doesn't understand that it's not about Democrat, Republican, Cheech and Chong politics. He said it like, well, then you're going to have to prosecute the Democrats. You're darn right you're going to have to prosecute the Democrats because they were a part of it. They created a lot of these programs.
But I agree with you. You know, Reid, who I think recently essentially said no Guantanamo person should come in here.
Exactly.
That guy should be put to pasture. If the Democrats stand for anything, he should be out to pasture. But the answer is, they don't stand for anything. And when I get these calls from a few sort of people who stand up, whether it's the Jerry Nadlers of the world, what does it all mean? It doesn't mean anything. Those guys, to the extent they have voices at all, they're completely meaningless within the Democratic Party.
I think this is why it's important not to view this through the lens of partisanship. This is a law enforcement issue, but it's a law enforcement issue that has grave implications for the future, not only of the United States, but of the world. When you have the United States as a signatory to treaties that prohibit this kind of torture, when you have laws within the United States that prohibit this kind of torture, when you have blatant violations of the Geneva Convention, and you say, we're not going to prosecute because we need to look forward, not backwards, when you say that you have to have reflection, not retribution. What you're saying then to a common thug on the street in the United States who wants to rob an old lady is the next time the cops pull you over, say, hey, buddy, I'm not going to do it again. Reflection, not retribution. I mean, that's what I'm going to say the next time I ever get pulled over by a cop. I'm going to say, well, you heard Obama. Reflection, not retribution.
Let me tell you,
don't give me a ticket.
The people fighting against dictatorships around the world, Africa in particular that I speak to, they just think this is a license for those oppressors to just torture and then put some legal memos in front of it and say, well, the U.S. did it and we did it. And, you know, you've been on this as the center is insisting that this is such BS by Obama when he says look forward. Looking forward to a future without torture is guaranteed by prosecution, not by impunity. Impunity guarantees a future of torture. But as you said, torture is currently going on. The IRF squads, forced feeding, and who knows about Bagram.
There was a lot of hope. I think you and I would agree probably more illusion than hope, but a lot of hope before Obama was elected. And there were a lot of people that we rubbed shoulders with, supported him even if critically, but supported him nonetheless. And you didn't take that position, which I thought was a courageous one. I heard you give a speech, which wasn't a popular speech, but you did it nonetheless. My question to you is, what do you tell these people now? You can't say, I told you so. But in a more diplomatic way, what do you say to the people whose hopes are steadily being crushed now by the direction that the Obama administration has been going into ever since the first appointments came out? What do you tell these people now?
You know, when I was criticizing or exposing a Republican-run company under a Republican administration during a Republican-controlled Congress, I was all over the TV shows. I was allowed to, you know, write for magazines, the sort of establishment press on the left, all this stuff. But my phone is not ringing so much these days. And I actually have people standing up and walking out of speeches. This happened to me at American University not long ago, where a group of students, when I was criticizing Obama, stood up and walked out.
Wow.
It's cult-like behavior, and it's somewhat chilling. I mean, name the countries in the world, I've been to a few of them, where people walk around with the president's face on T-shirts. Like, this is sort of unheard of in the United States. When you're walking around with the face of a man who is in control of the most powerful empire in history, with nuclear weapons deployed around the world, with hundreds of nations with its forces in one form or another deployed there, with two overt hostile occupations going on, when people walk around with the face of the leader of that country on their shirt, it says something about how deeply hypnotized people have become in this country. But I don't think it's wise to lash out at the people who support Obama or believe that he was going to be about change. What I'm finding, Michael, to directly answer your question, the facade is starting to crack, ever so slightly, but it's starting to crack. People are realizing now these wars aren't ending. This torture is still continuing. Yes, there's a heck of a lot of people out there that come hell or high water are going to defend Obama, as one union leader told me the other day. But the reality is those that have eyes to see are not going to be blinded for that much longer. And I think we're at yet another crucial moment in our history where we have to reflect on the one-party system that we have. And it's not popular to talk about that in Barack Obama, but this isn't a popularity contest. It's about what's right. If anyone knows that, it's you guys defending the defenseless.
I want to go back to the IRFs, but one of the problems is that Nala, for example, with his reconstitution of military commissions, conceivably a preventive detention scheme coming out last week on Guantanamo, is you just see the need for some kind of system of plurality voting or something where, you know, Obama says, well, these people are going to vote for me anyway. I don't care about my left side or my liberal side.
Right.
They got nowhere to go. And the problem is, until we have a system where there's a left that has somewhere to go that can actually do something in the balance, we're never going to get anywhere. And even that.
It's interesting the way you're putting that, Michael, because I think, you know, Glenn Greenwald, who's been fantastic on these issues, writes a lot about this sort of false notion of the centrist intellectuals, you know, all these sort of, you know, establishment figures that represent a mythical centrism that actually constantly is apologizing for the crimes of the state. This isn't a left-right issue, actually. I learned this doing the Blackwater thing. Some of my fiercest defenders when I was doing that work were military people who were not anti-war. This issue of torture should not be viewed as a partisan issue. The Democrats have no credibility on it. That's why it's not a partisan issue. I wish it was. I wish all the Democrats were making a partisan issue and saying, we don't torture and we mean it, meaning it stops now. That's not what they're doing. They can torture. They can have their administration allowing torture. But let's also let the Bush people off the hook, because for political reasons, it would be improper for us to do that. That's why my faith is in lawyers at this point, suing the heck out of these people. It's been that way for years. The Democrats had their spines surgically removed years ago.
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
And that's why it's
it's a combination of lawyers, pressure from the public, whether it's Catholic
sad.
Workers
it shouldn't
and
be
others.
That way. It shouldn't
no,
be that
that's
way.
All the that's really all we got. And the European prosecutions are going to be important in this, because I agree with you. I mean, I think we've made huge gains on the idea that you have to have prosecutions. It's stronger than I ever thought it would be in this country, but it's not there yet by a long shot. In your article on the immediate reaction forces at Guantanamo, you actually describe in some detail what happens when one of these groups goes in.
Right. I mean, what often happens, and, you know, James Yee, the former army chaplain at Guantanamo, described how he was so disgusted that he would cringe at the thought of being present when one of these IRF raids would happen. On paper, according to the standard operating procedures that were declassified, written by Major General Jeffrey Miller, who was the sort of torture kingpin at Guantanamo on the ground and then gitmoized Abu Ghraib and others, they say that these IRF teams should never be used as punishment. They should only be used when necessary to put down either a sort of rebellious uprising on the part of the prisoners, or if a prisoner is being combative. What I found, though, was that they were being used to punish prisoners for the most minor of infractions. They would go into the cells. They were authorized to use two dousings of chemical agents. They would go in and they would literally hogtie these prisoners, you know, arms and legs behind their torso. And they would sometimes leave them tied like that. They were required to film them. And yet sources I have say that they wouldn't even put the film in the camera. They would go in with the camera, but then there would be no tape in the camera.
Well, you know,
they
claim, because we, of course, asked for all these films and tapes through our Guantanamo
litigation. 500
litigation.
Hours, they say there is. ACLU tried to get them and then backed off of it for tactical reasons, is what I heard. There are at least 500 tapes out there. Well, I think the ACLU was trying to get all of the photos released, and they felt that it would have muddied the issue at that time. I think it should be revisited. I think that there should be renewed lawsuits to attempt to get all of the tapes. There must be thousands of hours of tapes, because some of these prisoners were IRFed 32 times in one calendar year. Some of them were IRFed 8 times in one week.
We also heard, of course, I think maybe BS, as our lawyers have requested these tapes, that they were taped over, you know, they would tape it and then tape it over, or that they were some of the tapes were
Well,
blank.
That would be destruction of evidence, because the fact is that in the standard operating procedure, there are two forms of evidence that are supposed to be gathered and maintained. One is the videotaping of these raids, and the other is sworn statements from the military police officers that participate in the IRFings. I went through hundreds of pages of declassified incident reports. Literally, there's almost 400 pages of these incident reports, and all of them, it was like they were written by the same person, but with different handwriting. They all talk about how they went off without a hitch, the prisoner was unharmed, medical evaluation Foundation cleared them and they were returned to the cell. What I found was a series of broken bones of people who, in the case of Omar Daeg Hayes, who lost sight in his right eye, one of Clive Stafford Smith's clients. And the fact is, this hasn't just happened to prisoners at Guantanamo. There was a U.S. soldier named Sean Baker, and this is perhaps the only reason why a lot of people have even heard of these forces. In 2003, Sean Baker, who was a military police officer, a Gulf War veteran, was ordered by his superiors to put an orange jumpsuit on and act as though he was a Guantanamo detainee and that he was going to be a little bit restive or combative. And he was told explicitly, the other soldiers who are going to be practicing subduing you know that you're a U.S. soldier, and if it gets too rough for you, call out the code word, which is red. Well, when Sean Baker was in that cell in an orange suit, the men who went in to subdue him were not told that he was a U.S. soldier, and they beat him into a pulp. And when he's yelling, red, red, they're still beating him, even though he was saying the code. On top of that, he finally said, I'm a U.S. soldier. I'm a U.S. soldier. And one of the guys came up and beat him again some more after that. That guy has permanent brain damage. He suffers from 10 to 12 seizures a day, and he was a U.S. soldier. As Scott Horton told me, that's one guy who is a uniformed member of the United States military who was beaten to a pulp by his fellow soldiers even after he said, I'm a U.S. soldier. Imagine what happens to a detainee whose lawyer maybe sees him a couple times a year and who everyone is going to say he's lying because he's a terrorist. Imagine what happens to these people.
And of course, these guys were earthed before they had lawyers at all.
Of course.
And when they were presumed to be wrongly terrorists.
I mean, my sense is that you had some of the most sadistic, twisted actions happening to these prisoners by these forces. I mean, what happened during the interrogations, of course, is we know about it. It's reprehensible. Right. It's a crime. But I sort of see a slight difference between these two forces. There was something systematic about what the interrogators were doing, and it's sick, and it's criminal. It should be prosecuted. What these forces, these IRF forces were doing is it's essentially sending in a bunch of bouncers from a bar to do whatever they want. It's not even sort of organized chaos. It's just a free-for-all. Gang beat them. Do sadistic. They stick their heads in a toilet. They also took hoses and put the hoses point blank up to the nose and turned on full blast the water. Not just waterboarding, but these IRF teams created their own thing, which was no cloth over the mouth. Just stick a hose into their nose and turn it on at full blast. I mean, what kind of sick, twisted individuals? Like, were these all people that at age 4 were like murdering squirrels and things? I mean, this is sick. These are the people that the U.S. has unleashed on unarmed prisoners.
This is really a story that hasn't been told. Where did your article appear initially?
It came out at Alternet, and we alternet.org, and we sent it around everywhere.
I mean, I've seen it in a lot of places.
Well, I mean, but we, you know, this is a story I think that should have been, raised in by the Congress. It could have been on the floor of the Senate today when people are talking about Guantanamo. Not a single senator raised the ongoing abuses. I heard Inhofe, earlier in the Senate debate on the closure of Guantanamo, talking about how great the treatment is of prisoners at Guantanamo. That's outrageous. He should be called to task on that.
It's amazing. What's been the reaction to your article, other than getting around to a lot of the at least progressive media?
No, nothing, because the Democrats won't touch it. And the blue state Fox, you know, the corporate media now, they won't touch it either. It's amazing. We have state media in this country. Under Bush, it was sort of the Fox Murdoch stuff. Now under Obama, it's the kind of MSNBC. I call it blue state Fox. It's like Obama state media with a few exceptions here and there.
But Jeremy, step back and make a broader point, because it seems to me that this kind of torture that's going on in Guantanamo, or you see the same thing going on now in Afghanistan with the appointment of McChrystal, who had these torture teams for 5 years before he got his promotion. What's going on here? Is this racism? Is this the kind of characters that come to the fore in an imperial system? What's the dynamic here? What are your thoughts about it kind of philosophically?
Some people say that, you know, Obama is turning his back on his campaign rhetoric of change and all those things. And they, you know, then there's other people who say, well, you know, Obama is somehow playing an act where he's somehow tricking, the right wing belligerent types. And at some point, the real Obama is going to emerge to save the world and bring peace, freedom and democracy everywhere. The reality is, I think that we have had a very, very consistent U.S. foreign policy going back for many, many decades. It cuts across partisan lines and political lines in Washington. You had Bill Clinton, during his 8 years in power, lay the groundwork for every single of the most repressive policies enacted under Bush, where you had the precursor for the Patriot Act passed under Bill Clinton. You had the Omnibus Crime Bill passed under Bill Clinton. You had NAFTA and all of these neoliberal trade regimes passed under Bill Clinton. You had the bombing of Iraq. You had the bombing of Afghanistan, Sudan, all of these other countries. Then you had Bush pick it up and run with it, destroy internationally the U.S. reputation. Obama comes in, and this is what the Democrats generally do. He cleans up the reputation with the world but continues the policies. And in the case of Afghanistan, actually escalates them and makes the situation worse. Obama credits himself with coming up with the plan to increase the number of troops in Afghanistan. That's what he's doing on the ground. He had a bombing the other day that killed 150 Afghan civilians. He has drunken Blackwater guards shooting civilians in traffic in Kabul, Afghanistan in early May. He has his new mercenary company, Triple Canopy, taking over Blackwater's role in Iraq. So politically, Michael, to answer your question, I think that there's nothing surprising about what Obama is doing. Those who are surprised are people that bought into the myth that there actually is a dime's worth of difference when it comes to foreign policy. Now, I'm not a domestic policy expert, but I'll say this. No single-payer health care proposal coming from Obama, despite the fact that he told people when he launched his political career, I'm going to make passionate support for single-payer health care my priority. His economic so-called bailout is a bailout for huge corporations. They're not nationalizing banks. The banks are privatizing the government. On every of the most – that's Naomi Klein's line, not mine. I won't take credit for it. On the issues that matter most, from immigration to the economy to health care to war policy, Obama has more in common with George Bush than he has with the poor of the United States or anywhere else in the world. And that's the sad fact.
What do you do about it?
You know, we are at absolute ground zero when it comes to confronting this system. What Obama has done is completely and totally sucked the air out of all of the social movements that were either co-opted by the Democratic Party or willingly folded themselves into the Obama campaign mechanism. The credibility of some of the groups that were out in the streets in 2002, 2003 in massive numbers was frittered away during this election campaign season. I think that irreparable damage was done to some of the larger anti-war organizations because of their allowing the Obama campaign to fold them into it and buying into to what Phil Berrigan called the big lie, that somehow actual change is going to come from the established political parties in this country. I think we are years away from having the actual kind of dialogue that we need to have in this country. Perhaps the economic crisis is going to create conditions where people do start talking about this. I think, and you know, call me naive or whatever, but I was born at night, but not last night. Mm-hmm. I think that we need to have an actual discussion in this country about breaking this one-party system. For all the attacks that people want to launch on Ralph Nader, Nader didn't lose the election in 2000 for the Democrats. Al Gore did by refusing to stand up to a stolen election. And the fact is that what Nader has been saying, and I'm not, you know, working for Ralph Nader or a big Ralph Nader supporter, but I bring his name up because he's been the clearest voice for decades in this country saying that until we address that, the duopoly, we are not going to go anywhere in this country. There's wisdom in that. And I think that there's a lot of young people in this country that are turned on to politics right now in a way that they weren't. And to me, that gives me hope because I think we have a starting point for this discussion. So I think that it's going to be starting to get back into the streets. The largely white anti-war left needs to start understanding what's happening in non-white communities across the country, reaching out to those issues. Katrina was shameful in the lack of support from the sort of white liberal classes. I'm not talking about going down there with Habitat for Humanity to rebuild homes. I'm talking about standing with people who are being evicted from their homes. I'm talking about rising up against the death penalty. There were thousands of people out in New York and tens of thousands more across the country protesting against the impending execution of Troy Davis. A lot of those people were not white people. So it's a matter of understanding what are the issues that are impacting non-white communities in this country. You start reaching out to people there and you're going to see that there's more criticism. Even though Obama's wildly popular in the black community, the black community, I think, is largely open to criticism more than white liberals are. That's what I'm finding. And so that gives me hope that there are communities that are going to welcome actual, honest dialogue because their lives depend on actually changing the system.
Your book, Blackwater, has a new edition out in paperback now?
Yeah, there's a chapter about Blackwater under Obama. And, you know, at my website, rebelreports.com, you can read about Obama's position on mercenaries and other issues. I update it every day.
How do you pronounce the new name that they've given themselves since you've destroyed their company?
Well, it's like Prince, you know. It's a symbol now, Michael. I'm not, it's a name I dare not speak. So it's Z, but it's X-E. I call the whole thing that Obama's doing in Blackwater's part of its occupation rebranded.
We're on the same page here. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Been duped. The global celebrity status of President Obama has been molded into a brand, writes Chris Hedges, former Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. Obama's campaign was a marketer's dream and won the vote of top marketer in Advertising Age magazine. Chris Hedges' article, Buying Brand Obama, takes a scathing look at how clever marketing diverts public attention away from the critical issues such as the expansion of the war, Obama's rejection of a single-payer health care system, his refusing to prosecute the Bush administration for war crimes, and allowing Bush-era surveillance and secrecy laws to remain intact. Chris Hedges is with us today to talk more about these advanced marketing schemes.
Chris Hedges, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Chris, you wrote an article recently called Brand Obama. What do you mean by that in terms of the advertising that went into getting Obama's elected?
Well, that's what Obama is. When you compare the image that has been presented and the reality of what the Obama administration is doing, there's just a wild disconnect, which is bridged only through the very clever manipulation of illusion, which is what the public relations industry does. That $600 million had to go somewhere, and that's where it went. It's no accident that hundreds of marketers, agency heads, and marketing services vendors at the Association of National Advertisers annual conference in October named the Obama campaign Advertising Age's Marketer of the Year, including beating, companies like Apple. Listen to the professionals. Obama is a marketer's dream. He does one thing. He, like any brand, gets you to believe another.
Yeah,
that is the essence of successful advertising.
Now, I agree, and I'm interested in how he did it, because here we are. I mean, a lot of the country's concerned by single-payer health care. They're concerned about refusal to prosecute the Bush administration, surveillance, secrecy, and particularly, of course, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. These are all issues that we're being, obviously, many people are being deeply disappointed by, but somehow they sold Obama on these issues. I mean, the two don't square. How do they do it? I mean, how are
people... Same way Calvin Klein sells us underwear. If you remember, there was, and I think it was a disastrous decision on the part of the left to get involved in the 70s when I was in college in identity politics. It was all about how can we get people of color up on big billboards. And, companies like Bennington or Calvin Klein were the precursors to the Obama brand, and that they figured out how to use risque art and even progressive politics to give themselves an edge. But the goal is the same, which is to make passive consumers mistake a brand with an idea or an experience. And I think that veering away from the radical economic understanding that issues of class and oppression that had traditionally been part of the women's and the civil rights movement in the 60s. The conflation of causes into this campaign of political correctness rendered an entire generation of activists impotent and has seduced them into confusing the politics of image with action. Naomi Klein writes about this, I think, quite effectively in No Logo.
If you drew a balance sheet now about Obama with respect to his promises and what he delivered on, what would that balance sheet look like?
He promised to end the war in Iraq. That was completely disingenuous. But, you know, during the campaign, he talked about Afghanistan as, you know, the right war and all this kind of stuff. So he didn't really make a lot of promises. I mean, it was sloganeering. It was the confusion of propaganda or campaign as experience with ideology.
All that stuff, we can, but what's the content? Or
yeah,
change
was,
with Obama,
sure,
but what's the content?
I mean, I
think that's absolutely the point you're really making about advertising. Is
right.
That they got all the slogans out there with completely hollow underneath.
Right. It's what Benjamin DeMott calls junk politics in his book, Junk Politics. Junk politics is not about demanding justice or the reparation of rights. It always personalizes. These campaigns are about personal narrative. It moralizes issues. It doesn't clarify them. That it's about optimism. It's about the future. It's about our, you know, making ourselves feel as if our candidates are us. They feel our pain. They speak our language. And the result of junk politics is that nothing changes. There is no interruption in the process and the dominance of the corporate state and the permanent war economy that we live under. And I think Obama is a classic example of how rebranding has allowed the disintegration of American democracy and the furtherance of the politics of empire. I mean, you know, when you imperial politics always destroy domestic politics, that the ruthlessness and brutality employed by imperiums always circle back onto their hosts, and that's not a new story. Thucydides and Plutarch wrote about it during Athens' expanding empire, that the tyranny that Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself, and we're going through exactly the same process.
I think that's critical. You know, when you gave that speech and included part of that when you were supposedly booed off the stage in Ohio.
Well, I wasn't supposedly.
You
I
were.
I was definitely booed off the stage.
Booed, but with actually physically pushed off the stage.
Well, yeah,
right before the election?
Yeah, that was 2003.
Yeah.
Way before.
And I used that quote of yours about Thucydides, I think, in a dozen speeches afterwards of the Imperium abroad being brought home. It was just so critical. It always reminded me, I won't divert here too much, but of a famous Vietnam poster that we used to have. It was a bunch of armed soldiers and guards in front of a library in New York, maybe Lowe Library at Columbia. And underneath it had Johnson's slogan, just to see how we're dealing with people abroad, look at how we're dealing with people at home. We're talking to Chris Hedges, who just came out with a wonderful recent article called Buying Brand Obama. And where can people see that article, Chris?
This is a column I write every Monday for Robert Shear's web magazine out of L.A. called Truth Dig.
So it's on Truth Dig. I think a lot of us know that. Go there because it's a really crucial article about the difference between Obama as essentially an advertising icon and what real politics represent. But Chris, I want to go to some of the substantive issues with you now. I know we've had you on here on different issues, but can you give us some current take on Afghanistan and the appointment of McChrystal as the new head of the Afghan forces?
Well, you know, this is a disastrous move on the part of the Obama administration. Afghanistan, like Iraq, is not a winnable proposition. The situation in Afghanistan has deteriorated markedly. I'm not sure that the American public quite grasps how precarious the hold on Afghanistan is. Daylight attacks carried out by the Taliban in the center of Kabul. As a foreigner, you cannot walk the streets of Kabul for fear of being kidnapped. You have to travel in cars. You certainly cannot go beyond the city limits, not only of Kabul, but Kandahar and everywhere else. If you leave for the countryside, especially in the south, you cannot do so unless you are embedded with NATO forces. The Taliban controls at least 50% of the country. They controlled about 75% of Afghanistan when we went in 2001. The UN estimates they're raking in about $300 million a year from control of the poppy and heroin trade. And we are rapidly expanding the war into Pakistan. If you look at what happened during the Vietnam War with Cambodia, it's a very similar situation. This constant bombing, which is only agitates or increases the insurgency. The heavy use of air power, and of course we just saw this disastrous strike with perhaps as many as 140 civilians killed. I think the figure I read was something like 90 children. You can imagine what this does within the Afghan population. So the war, number one, is going badly, and number two is all of the tactics that are being employed are, and you know, I speak as someone who spent many, many years of my life covering conflicts and insurgencies, including when I started 5 years during the war in El Salvador, is counterproductive. Now, Obama has very little foreign policy experience and no experience in war, and he has essentially turned to the militarists to guide him, and I think many ways the same way Lyndon Johnson turned to Westmoreland and others. And I think that there is a historical analogy here, which is apt. This is a situation which is going to suck us down a very deep black hole. And Obama signed on for the trip.
I think so, too. Talk to us about Obama's relationship with the financial community, which I think is the other side of the coin of his relationship with the militarists.
It is. And the Obama administration has once again followed the lead of the Bush administration. It has spent, lent, or guaranteed at this point some $12.8 trillion in taxpayer dollars handed out to Wall Street. And these firms like AIG, in a court of law, are criminal. You know, the British have seized all the AIG files and are charging them with fraud, as well as insolvent banks. And what's frightening is that it is this bizarre effort to reinflate a bubble through massive loans. Which, by the way, you know, we can never pay back. So the tactic, at best, is going to forestall catastrophe. But when that catastrophe comes, we're not going to have resources. We are, in essence, going to be broke in a time of profound crisis. Figures like Larry Summers, essentially, you know, allowing Larry Summers to be the guiding hand. I mean, this is the man who, along with Robert Rubin and others, wrecked the economy in the first place, I think is as damning of the Obama administration as his decision to maintain the American imperium.
I know that you didn't support Obama when he ran for president.
I voted for Ralph Nader.
I liked McKinney. But what
well,
do we...
Yeah, I could. I'm up for close. A lot of that's personal. I like Cynthia, too. But
yeah, I mean, it was six. I supported Ralph the year
before. Well, I support that. Ralph because nobody does. But, you know, poor Ralph. So I figured, you know what? I'm going to go down with Ralph even if nobody else. Me and Patti Smith.
I know, you know, this is an interview we're conducting a few days before our show, and I know you're out in Berkeley right now. It's actually related to your Obama article, and you're getting a...
An honorary doctorate
with
Dr. Hedges, pretty soon.
Right. We'd be Dr. Hedges, and we'll have to refer to you along with Dr. Jeremiah Wright, who I think already has a doctorate.
Well, he earned his. Right. His is real.
But he's getting another one with you.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that here you are talking about, you know, the brand Obama in your recent article on Truthdig, and you're getting a honorary degree with someone who, you know, was at least seemed to have been cast aside quite dramatically.
Ruthless.
By Obama.
Ruthlessly.
Cast under a bus, Michael.
Yeah, and just give us your thoughts on what it feels like to be honored with Jeremiah Wright, as well as what you think about what happened to him.
Well, I'm a great fan of Jeremiah Wright, and I urge everyone to take time to listen to either his long talk at the National Press Club or that sermon, that 40-minute sermon in which that extract "God of America" was used to essentially lynch him, carry out a kind of media lynching of one of the most prophetic and, I think, profound voices in American society. You know, the way Obama cast him aside, including, I hear, under the table offering him money not to speak publicly during the campaign, It's just appalling. And I think that it, again, illustrates Obama's lack of character and fortitude. Right, like Kucinich, like Ralph. I mean, these are, you know, and I know all of them. I just had dinner with Wright. I can't claim to know him well, but I certainly know Dennis and Ralph. I mean, these are very, very serious people, you know, who understand structures, understand systems, care deeply about social justice, democratic equality. And what do they do? What does the media do? It doesn't compete or it doesn't challenge them on their ideas. It turns them into figures of ridicule. You saw it. Even the Washington Post, during the campaign, the primaries, was writing about how short Kucinich was and how his ears stuck out. And they did the same thing to Wright. it's very, very disturbing because these are voices that so desperately need to be heard, that need to be part of the narrative and part of the debate. And corporate media quite effectively turns these people into pariahs. And that's what they did to Wright. And Obama, who is a consummate politician, is, I think, at this point willing to sell out just about every belief he once had, whether it's on Israel-Palestine, whether it's on the war, whether it's on single-payer, not-for-profit health care, for power, tossed away, I think, a figure who of great moral probity and wisdom, and replaced him with
Rick.
Figures from a bankrupt elite like Larry Summers.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I always have trouble understanding how we could have sat in that church and heard Reverend Wright Sunday after Sunday giving these powerful speeches about what's right and what's wrong with America and the history, and yet with like almost the flick of a finger just rejected all and not even puts any of those lessons into practice.
That's cynical, but I think it was a church with over 10,000 members, and it was a beginning of a good power base.
Reverend Wright is quite a figure in Chicago.
Sure.
And that church runs serious outreach programs. I mean, really serious social justice stuff. Many people have charged, as you just said, that Obama realized that tying himself to the coattails of Dr. Wright and his church was a very savvy and astute move for a rising politician in Chicago. And I don't know what his motives were, but unfortunately he decided in the end to listen to his pollsters and media spin doctors rather than his pastor. And we're all worse off for that decision.
Chris Hedges, the bloom is coming off the rose with Obama, and it hasn't even been 120 days. But what do we tell people now? Where do we go from here? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's the problem's not Obama. The problem is the American left, which forgot that it's not our job to take power. As Karl Popper had it right, the great Viennese philosopher, the open society and its enemies, most people who seek power and attain power are mediocrities. Very rarely do you get a figure of any real moral or intellectual depth. The question is not how do we get good people to rule. The question is, how do we build a system so the people who rule have diminished power and can't screw us? And I think that the left has signed on with a bankrupt Democratic Party, which doesn't support any of the issues purportedly the left. I mean, like these progressives for Obama, run by Tom Hayden and others. You know, do progressives support the death penalty? Do we support the war in Afghanistan? Do we support a for-profit healthcare industry that actually makes money off people's suffering and death? We have to hold fast to our own issues, and we have to lobby and fight for them. And you know, politics is a game of pressure. We have to, and we don't do that. And look on MoveOn.org has become an arm of the Obama campaign.
I mean, the stuff I get from them is really bad. It's about supporting the stuff that I wouldn't in my life support.
Yeah, and it's hollowness. I just am rereading Notes from the Underground Man, Dostoevsky's great work, and the book is an assault on what happens to liberalism, what happens to a bankrupt liberalism, which took hold in Russia in the latter part of the 19th century, and as Dostoevsky correctly points out, it always leads to moral nihilism, that when you have a bankrupt liberalism, an ineffectual liberalism, which we have, in a time of crisis and despair, which we are entering, I mean, profound dislocation, then you have destroyed all of your credibility as a social movement, and especially allowing Americans to remain in this self-delusional belief that everything is going to go back to the way it was and we are always going to be powerful and rich. You're essentially maintaining a population in a state of childishness. You know, they never grow up because they never face face reality. And that's part of the Obama illusion, part of the Obama brand. And the danger is that when the disparity between what we believe and what is actually real becomes so vast that we can no longer ignore it. I mean, you know, when they're coming to drive us out of our foreclosed home, then you, like a child, because you're unprepared for what's coming and coping with the new limitations that we're all going to have to deal with, you react with a kind of rage, and you search for a savior, for a demagogue to save you. And I think that in American society is especially dangerous because of the very deep undercurrent of violence. And I think that as the longer we remain in a state of self-delusion, and the worst offenders of this are the American left, who have tied their, you know, are backing a party which doesn't advance any of the things that the left purports to consider important, the more dangerous this becomes for our very anemic democracy.
That's a really, I mean, completely, I'm sitting here just really stunned by how meaningful and wonderful that statement is, and sad in its own way. I don't know, if it's not really related in any particular way, but I saw the movie about Salvador Dali and Buñuel as well, and Garcia Lorca the other day, and I walked out with my daughter and I said, I think we need it. It's a time when it looks like for another Dada movement, you know, the movement that came up after the First World War, because everybody was completely down, and it's like the nihilism that you're talking about. I mean, that reflects the period that you're addressing, and I think it's right.
I think people like you and Michael and I and all the rest of us who are on the same page here have to start talking about having our own, essentially, self-defense organizations.
I do want to just put in a mention here. You had a lot of great books. A lot of them have been some great sellers, some less so, but they're all good. And this newest one is your new book called Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. It'll be out in July, can be pre-ordered on Amazon.
Go to your local bookstore first.
Bookstore and just say one or two sentences about it. I want to say the name once more, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle.
It's about living in a society where we no longer can distinguish between lies and truth. It's about a post-literate society that has confused images, manipulated images with the way we're made to feel with knowledge. Societies like that essentially embark on a project of self-annihilation.
You know, Chris, you rarely hear things that are new and refreshing and interesting, and we do from you, so I really appreciate your work.
Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Not at all, anytime.
Have fun tonight.
I will.
Congratulations.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thank you.